Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am really excited about today's show. I forgot to tell you that In the Drink actually is the show that brings you some of the most interesting people of the beverage industry, and we've got one of them in studio with us today. We have Jules Dresner, who is the Jules Dresner at Louis Dresner Selections. They import and also distribute sometimes some of the greatest wines in the world. These are wines that I think are required reading for really anyone who has a wine list with European wines. And a little bit of South American wine, but when I opened up my wine bar in Fora back in 2010, I was like, okay, we're gonna have a bunch of Dresner wines, and then build the rest of the list around these core outstanding wines. Jules, I'm so excited to have you in the studio today.
Oh well, thank you. You know, I've always felt that I had a face for radio, so I'm ready for this.
You have the experience and a wit for radio, and I know you before you got into the wine business, you were kind of involved in music a little bit, right? And you still sort of are. What were you doing before?
I mean, yeah, I was, you know. To preface that, the company is 30 years old. I'm 31. So I was always around what my parents started, and it, you know, profoundly shaped me, mostly out of, you know, not out of choice at first, because my summer vacations were them basically going and visiting growers in Europe and working. And they worked from home the first, you know, 8 years of the company, and they started from nothing. So it was really something that always was around with me and always resonated with me on the level of being independent, mm-hmm. answering to nobody but yourself, creating something from nothing. You know, they knew nothing about wine. They knew nothing about business. They knew nothing about the myriad of very boring laws that surround this type of work. But here we are. We find ourselves 30 years later. Well, 88 will be the 30th anniversary.
Was there a push to encourage you to be part of it, or did they say
no? It was on my own. I mean, I know it made my father and my mother happy. Although, you know, my father, for those who don't know, was terminally ill. Was diagnosed with cancer in late 2008, and died in September 2011. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, I was doing, you know, they had that very kind of figure it out yourself approach to life, which, you know, growing up in New York City can lead to all types of interesting adventures, you know. So my whole thing was, you know, I think this is the classic, you see what your parents do, you don't want to do that, and I had no interest in it. Mm-hmm. You know, I liked drinking Beaujolais and Muscadet when I was 12 years old at lunch.
Do you remember your first wine? Was it something special?
I mean, no. I remember the first time I got really drunk. I was 7. It was on the cider. Yeah, Norman cider.
Were your parents around?
Or yeah,
you,
like, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know. The
Norman cider had a little sweetness.
Yeah, it was the doux. So it was the one with a lot of sugar. It just tastes like fizzy apple juice, you know. And next thing you know, it's like me and my sister, who's 5, like passed out at the table at lunch. And yet we still drank some at dinner. So, you know, it's the attitudes are not at all like in America, mm-hmm. in Europe. Although, well, speaking of lax attitudes, that's pretty lax. But for the music stuff, yeah, I was just, you know, I was I grew up in New York City. I was always really enamored by the culture of music in this city and how much it's influenced the world, how much it's influenced me. When I was younger, it was all about rap, hip hop, stuff. And the first time I heard scratching, I was like, I have to do that. So I got some really shitty turntables and started practicing all day on my dad's old Bowie records, and which he did not like, because one, I was terrible and it sounded like shit, and two, I was fucking up his old records that were, to be fair, not in very good condition.
Maybe the only thing worse than like having a kid who's trying to learn the drums is like he's trying to learn to scratch, and it's like really bad.
Yeah, it's really bad. And also, I mean, I'm the first one to admit that like good scratching sounds really amazing for like 5 minutes, and then you're like, okay, I'm so over this. No matter who you are, unless you're the biggest scratch nerd, it just starts sounding exactly the same and is really annoying, even for me now. And so after a while, I realized I sucked at scratching. And started mixing more and kind of throwing parties, and a little bit in high school, then was promoting and throwing parties in college, moved to the Bay Area as like a final push for music production and DJing, and then kind of needed a job, started working at a wine shop, started putting things together that I'd never put together about the history of...
Was this a good and special wine shop, or is it like any old?
Yeah, it's Arlequin Wine Merchant in San Francisco. Yeah. So it's arguably the best wine shop in the Bay Area, at least in San Francisco for sure. Especially at the time when I was there in 2009. Now there's actually a lot of things that I would say more reflect kind of the times and my personal palate. But at the time, it was certainly, I think, the by far the best place to go for wines.
Been there, like, not only is it great wines, but because of the laws in California, you can actually just buy a bottle and they sell you some cheese, and you can sit down in the beautiful like garden and just enjoy something awesome.
Yeah, $5 corkage, and then you could just pop the bottle open, and, you know, which was amazing for us too. A part of my kind of getting into it was just, you know, The only way you're going to learn this type of stuff is by drinking a lot and tasting a lot, but drinking a lot, honestly, because if you're just tasting a sip of something, you go, okay, whatever. But if you're with a bottle, another bottle for the next vintage, that's when you start understanding things. So it was a great opportunity on that level. That's when I really, you know, started having that access to, well, also tasting with reps and going, you know, every day or every 4 days of the week, there'd be reps at 1 p.m. and we'd taste stuff. I was like, what is this? This is horrible. You know, like, these wines are terrible. Then I look at the price, I go, oh my God, this California thing would cost $60 on a shelf and it's undrinkable. And made me think about what I kind of already knew what I liked. I just didn't know anything about wine. Cause I've been drinking Beaujolais and Muscadet my whole life. So kind of shapes your palate.
Yeah, oh, totally. Having those, like, I mean, and those are the wines that today are, you know, so in demand and so cool amongst people who love, you know, wine. I think I drink Beaujolais at home, like my, and as someone who's a total loves Italian wine, Beaujolais is still like the one that I feel like I can get the most bang for your buck out of.
Bang for your buck, maybe, but I think it's just, you know, it's just this kind of ethos, and it's a big part of the, you know, the quote unquote natural wine movement is about pleasure and having and enjoying yourself with it, not taking it seriously. And I mean, sure, there's, I mean, I think a lot of Beaujolais ages beautifully, and there's Beaujolais made to age, but I think what encompasses just, you know, pleasure in drinking more than that?
Nothing. So. Okay, so you had some time out there, and you're falling more in love with wine, and you're sort of understanding a little bit better why you like the wines, and then what brought you back to the East Coast?
Well, I was connecting the dots more, you know, like, you know, just kind of, okay, I always knew organic, there's small independent producers, but all that stuff when you're, you know, when you're 9, 10, 15 even, it just doesn't sound like anything. It just sounds like, okay, you know, I knew that, you know, no chemicals, all this stuff. But the impact, I guess, of what these growers had on people, what my father and, you know, and of course my mother, but the impact they had on the U.S., the way they were able to introduce all these growers to people, the way they were able to let these independent farmers in environments that do not you know, were basically set up against their success to thrive and to become basically the de facto thing people look for when they look for quality now are these things, organic farming, hand harvesting, and then the whole winemaking process then goes to another level. But I think, you know, at this point, that's kind of, you know, it's like what, like how farm to table at this point, if you're not getting good, fresh, you know, local ingredients, That's just expected at this point.
Yeah,
it's like, not like, oh wow, good job. It's expected.
No good restaurant is serving like tomatoes in the winter. It's just, and if you get tomatoes in the summer in a restaurant, you should. And you're in a good restaurant, you should just assume that they're actually good local tomatoes because they should
be. Especially if they charge you $12 for three slices of tomatoes. Absolutely. It's a basil, you know.
Absolutely. So you came back and did you start working with your with a family business right away? Or
well, yeah. I mean, it's I actually started working. I started working with hired as an employee when I was living in the Bay Area. Still, okay. My father was getting worse, deteriorating, and we do an annual trip to France, centered around the Dives Bouteilles and all these wine fairs, basically. For those who don't know what they are, and we bring a lot of people. We bring the groups at this point are about 25 people, so they're large groups. It's almost like being a first grade teacher. You know, everyone has to hold hands. Now we're going here. Now it's cool. It works. We've got the system, and he, you know, he was always the one who led it because that's who he was, and he wasn't up to it to go. And the last year he went with 2010, and it's always at the very beginning of the year. And he said, look, I can't make it. I'm too weak to go. I want you to go. If you go, you know, if you want to give, you could give notice to Terroir, which is the first natural wine bar in the United States. So it's still open. They're going to celebrate their 10th anniversary, I think, this year.
In San Francisco.
In San Francisco. It has nothing to do with the places in New York. Yeah.
Great place.
Yeah, and another place I learned a ton from. You know, he said, go on that trip and I'll hire you. So, because I was already working on the website, which is the current iteration of it, which now, of course, 5 years later looks terrible and outdated. But
there's still, I have to say, still outstanding videos. There's just incredible, like, primary source material on the website.
Exactly.
I reference it a lot.
Yeah, the site, the contents. Is good.
It's but incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, but navigating it and all that, it looks outdated. But anyway, so then I went on that trip and was basically, you know, at that point writing all that content was essentially, you know, not quite full time job, but let's say just, you know, in between part time and full time job, because there's so much stuff to write, so much stuff to format, stuff to edit, to read, and so I was doing that, and then. Kind of, you know, it's a little melancholy, but what made me move back to the East Coast was when it was clear that my father wasn't going to live, and I felt that it made no sense for me to be so far away when the business was here in New York City, when my mother was here. And you know, it's much closer to Europe. So it just, you know, I wanted to do. So I just, you know, I had a conversation with my mother about it and I said, I'm going to move back. And that was in August, 2012. So I've been back already for 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for speaking so openly about this, by the way. And, sorry for your loss. I know the whole industry, you know, I didn't know him very well personally, but it was just a loss to everyone, someone who meant a lot as a real icon. And quick story, I was in Georgia with Alice Firing when she found out. I know she considered your dad a mentor and someone who taught her a ton, gave him a lot of credit. She tells a story about how she like would go to tastings and never liked any of the wines of the tasting and didn't know why. And then tasted his wines. And it's like, oh, I like these. And he helped her to understand why she liked the wines. But in Georgia, there's this ritual of giving long speeches, long speeches during the meal. People get up multiple times and there's someone who gives the speech and they're like the toastmaster for the night. But they'll also appoint other people to give a speech. And shortly after she found out, she gave an emotional speech in Georgia to this table, and it was absolutely beautiful. It was really heartfelt. And I think everyone, you know, there were people who at the table who knew him and people who didn't, and everyone understood the importance. And I think that a lot of people, like, people drink Georgian wines today a lot in some ways because of some of the paths that you guys
very indirectly, but indirect. Sure. Yeah, well, I didn't know that story.
You know that story?
No, I did not know that story.
Oh, you didn't know the story? Yeah. Yeah, I was there. I'm sure over the years, and on the website this morning, I was reading through the homage that you put
that was that we did that a year, like exactly a year after. That was very, very emotional, you know, sad, but of course so inspiring to compile all that, for me to translate a lot of that, because a lot of that was coming from French growers and you know, also growers that are like, you know, guys that are not big talkers or not big writers, are who don't give a lot on that level, write such long, concise, emotional passages was really something that, you know, not that it needed to be cemented in that people felt that way, but I'm very happy that came together.
And for, it's beautiful. I encourage anyone to read it. People just loved him. And even if they gave him a really hard time, they'd still,
Probably gave them a harder time. So
yeah, that's what I meant. Even if he he told Alice multiple times that she should stop writing. She had a terrible palate, and still his something about him is love, really incredible. But how do you integrate him, and what's his legacy for your company to this day?
Well, he's integrated. I mean, he's fully integrated. His name's on the back. You know, it's my name. It's an ethos. It's an attitude. It's a way of approaching things. An ethos, an attitude, and a way of approaching things. I don't really think I need to elaborate more than that. It's just our way of seeing the world. I think, in a way, it's just kind of this very journalistic kind of exposing people. Almost wine is secondary to a larger kind of whole, I think, or at least I feel that way. It wasn't wine itself that drew me closer to this. It was actually the people, the stories, seeing that they were happy and satisfied and doing something against the grain and, working together, finding each other, and also just fun, very interesting, good people. That's what drew me to it personally and still inspires me to do it. And then the wine is this thing that, brings it all together. It tastes good. I like to drink it too.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys on the website have a pretty clear set of criteria that you go for. Some of them are like wild yeast and hand harvesting, low yields. You guys can read them all on the website. How strictly do you try to stick to those things? It's like, if you taste a new wine, does it have to check off every single one of the...
Well, this is one of the big issues about wine in general, and it goes back to what I was saying about just the way you have to just approach it, from kind of an attitude or a feeling perspective. Look, I mean, there's wines that have no added sulfur that are, yeasted to death and fucking sterile filtered and just dead wines, but there's no sulfur in them. There's, and there's people that are going to tell you they're organic when they're not. There's people that are going to say that, so it's a thing. We all know that there's no ingredients on the back of the bottle. We all know that someone could tell you something, and, unless you see the bag of commercial yeast right there, you go, aha, I know it. You have to know what the wines taste like. You have to go see the vines. You have to, if you go look at vines, you're going to know right away, are they working well? Are they plowing? Are they using herbicides? Are they using pesticides? Are they treating the vines well? Are they pruning for lower yields to get more concentration? These are just things you see with time and you feel, and it's hard to explain, but if you've never, been to vineyards or have spent little time in them, after a while you feel different energies in organic or biodynamic vineyards versus conventional ones. You start to feel that, and it becomes intuitive. Right. And it's the same with native yeasts and stuff, or you know, a diluted wine from over yielded vines versus a concentrated one. And for me, the main trick I have with native yeast that Stefano Bellotti at Cascina degli Ulivi taught me, and it's never failed me, is if you take a sip, and if it's done with native yeast, it makes you salivate. So it's something that people probably don't even think about. But a wine with commercial,
I always associate that with acidity.
Native yeasts.
Huh, okay.
So, I mean, yeah, acidity too, sure. But, like, if it kind of, like, and stops, like, kind of cuts off, cut, you know, and doesn't linger, keep going, then it's a yeasted wine. So, you know, how true is that? You have to, you know, again, you have to use your own subjectivity and your own experience. But I've found that more often than not, that leads me in the sense that, and he always said, well, that's going to make you want to do one of two things. Eat some food or have another sip. And if you don't want to do those two things from the wine, then there's no point.
There's no point in that.
So that was, you know, I lived there when I was 20, and that was also a big turning point. I lived in lived on the farm and just spent a lot of time with him. So
do you have some other like real big aha moments that you can think of that along your wine journey?
I mean, I've touched upon the main ones. It was, you know, working at Arlequin, being exposed to all this wine that just was terrible and expensive. Yeah. I mean, terrible in my subjective opinion, and expensive, and just, you know, and then going, well, okay, then, you know, I just kind of always thought that good wine was the type of wine that my parents brought in, and all the other stuff was €2 wine. You know, I was just kind of, it was just like farmer wine and just shitty industrial supermarket wine. And so that was a big aha moment, just seeing how much of that, you know, world of, you know, spoofed out crazy shit existed. Stuff I've never tasted or even, you know, I maybe heard about it, but I didn't care.
Spoofed being an industrially produced wine.
Or, you know, over extracted, over oaked, over everything, kind of, you know, just powerful flavors to just kind of go, whoa. It's like what's happening with, you know, with the IPA beers now. It's just like, it's just about like, what's worse, the most powerful? It's like, which one could do the best Hulk Hogan impression? You know, and yeah, like you taste, you have one sip, you go, wow, that's powerful. And then you have another sip, and you're like, I don't want to fucking drink this. It sucks. So
I agree.
So it was, like, it was kind of
those
that.
Are, it's the same. Those are like the, you know, high alcohol, high oaked wines are those big IPA. I really hate them too.
Yeah,
like,
no, I mean, there's, you could, there's,
I wonder if there's going to be a sort of backlash to
that. Yeah, for definitely. Well. That's why Gose and all that stuff's happening right now. It's, you know, it's
and I love Kolsch. Kolsch might be the glue beer.
Kolsch,
right?
Kolsch, Pilsners, Lagers, you know, yeah. So that's what I drink. Sorry. That's what I know. Well, it's so that was the, you know, that was that kind of, and then, you know, tasting a lot of stuff and kind of figuring out, oh my God, this, you know, this is what I always knew what I liked, kind of, but now it was kind of going backwards for most people. It's like I knew the foundations of what I liked, but I had to piece together the technical information, kind of, while usually people, it's kind of the other way around, where they start with kind of shitty wine, or, you know, shittier wines, and then they kind of figure out what the ones they like that are better are.
Right.
So maybe it was the opposite.
Now, I mean, partly because of the success of your company, a lot of other people have started to bring in, you know, low, you know, organic wines, low sulfur wines, all this. Some of them are really excellent and some of them are really, really bad. How do you describe the kind of wines that you guys have and love? I've been saying natural wines that don't suck, but I think there has to be a better way to describe it. What do you, and how do you kind of deal with like the backlash with people bringing, you know, people like saying, just because, as you were talking before, like just because it's low sulfur doesn't mean it's good.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my dad always called them real wines, to kind of imply that there was no, you know, it was about, you know, tradition, old techniques, respecting the land, respecting the region's history, all that. So that's one way of putting it. I just like really, you know.
How do you feel about the natural? The term
I mean, you know, it's the same. It's like every 3 months I read another think piece about natural wine. I'm like, it's been the same think piece since at least that I can remember since I've been actively paying attention since 2007.
Yeah.
It's been 10 years of the same think piece. Like, I, you know, those critiques are valid, but they're always the same and they don't change anything. I think there's, you know, I'll give you an example. The first time I discovered carbonic maceration, it was Pierre Bertola Dilettante. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so good. Of course, that makes sense because Beaujolais is made that way. And so I was like, this is amazing. So I just went on this crazy, I want everything to be carbonic. And it's like, you know, that's what I was obsessed with. And that's what kind of, that was the first time I was like, oh, these wines bring me pleasure and give me enjoyment. And, you know, and I was like, and then I was drinking like, you know, carbonic Burgundy. I was like, this is the real Burgundy. And, you know, and people are like, you know, whatever, dude, you're like, you know, shut up, you're 24. But, you know, now, you know, I drink some carbonic Grenache, you know, and I'm like, this just tastes like nothing. It just tastes like, you know, like Kool-Aid. It's like, this is cool if it's like one in the morning and you just smoked a fat joint or something. And just like, it's like, tastes like nothing.
It tastes like the method over the.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And so, you know, you learn that. So I think a lot of people, especially people who have been drinking just, you know, boring ass filtered standard things, they see something and it looks like kombucha, it's cloudy, they go, what the fuck is this? This is crazy. Or they taste Brett, they're like, this is so funky. And then they start associating that with what they like because it's so different, and they could so identify that to profiles that are different that they like. And so then they're like, that's what good wine is. And then that then in turn they go, that's what natural wine is. And then they become those people who are just like, that's all they want to drink. And if that's all they want to drink, that's cool, because there's always going to be producers that are going to make wines like that. And, you know, we have producers that have made wines like that, or that, you know, in some cases still do make wines like that. You have to open your mind to it a little bit and kind of find context to it. And also, a lot of these people get better. That's the thing. I mean, if you were drinking Rene Moss, you know, 15 years ago, the shit would turn brown in 5 minutes.
Really?
You know, and that's like, okay, you're making Chenin with no sulfur, and it would just be like brown and oxidized in 5 minutes. And now,
so it's part of it, knowing like who has the passion and the talent to get better and to grow with them. Like, they're going to grow with you. And
a lot of the time, I think so, yeah. And, you know, I mean, look, you have guys now who will say, oh, drinking Moss is like drinking poison, you know, and those are the guys that are making those farty, you know, gassy, bready wines, you know.
I love Moss.
And, so that's what I mean. So it's just, you know, it's all just, you know, extremism always leads to extreme people being with extreme points of view. And, you know, and then if they become absolutes in their minds, you know, why argue with them? It's just, that's, you can't change people unless they want to change.
Yeah. So, no dogma.
So it's okay. You know, like the zeros, you know, it's like my friend was telling me, my friend Kenny, who makes Hobo wines and all that stuff, Hobo and Ghost Rider, he makes a bunch of stuff in California. He was at the Raw Wine Fair, and there's all these dudes like with Sulfur is Murder t-shirts.
No.
You know, at the Raw Wine Fair. And then they're all outside, a group of 10 of them, just, you know, chain smoking cigarettes. You know, it's all, you know, look, we're human beings. We contradict ourselves. We believe in one thing that, you know, there's logical fallacies everywhere.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I mean, I think we can take a little break, though, on the note that extremism in general is a bad thing. We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears here on Heritage Radio Network. My show is about people, life, and food. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1 o'clock to hear me talk with people from all walks of life. I interview artists, writers, healers, chefs, and much more. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. Your donations help keep us operating.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, Eat 'em to Save 'em, was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
All right, we are back on In the Drink with Jules Dresner from Louis Dresner Selections. Like I said at the top of the show, this is, I think, the most important wine importers and distributors. Someone, the wines I absolutely love. I drink them at home. Any restaurant that I will ever be a part of will have a significant selection of your wines. I feel like it. Anyone who has European wines should... any good list with European wines will have a significant amount of your wines. I feel very strongly about that. Anyway, the company started with all French wines, and anyone who knows me knows that I love Italian wines. And now you have some real iconic Italian producers like Elisabetta Foradori, La Stopa, which I actually just visited a month ago or so, which was absolutely awesome. Radicon, Occhi Pinti. You're wearing a Radicon t-shirt right now, for those of you who can't see. Something I actually had lunch in Bologna with Federico Orsi. What a great guy, and doing some really cool wines at just outside of the town of Bologna. Do you know the story as to how the company got into Italian wines? Because I think that there might be like French wine people and Italian wine people, at least maybe at one point there was. And so it was probably, I can imagine there had to be some sort of discussion to get into Italian wines.
Yeah, the discussion was, I mean, look, we didn't touch upon it, but basically, I mentioned that my parents started the company with no knowledge of wine whatsoever. So the growth into what they ended up doing, you know, finding people in the Beaujolais and the Loire Valley was totally organic and more trial and error. Because at that point, there was just no foundation. There was no idea of what, you know, what to look for. It's just kind of, let's see where this brings us. With Italy, what happened was in 99 or 2000, Alessandro Berra, whose family makes mostly Moscato, but also Barberas and crazy white wines. And
Vintage Moscato, which I've had some like older Moscato from Berra. Yep. It was released like 8 years ago. I remember I got some, and it was like, just trust me, this is awesome. Like we can't taste you on it. And that I don't know if I ever like accepted it other end, but it was like vintage Moscato, and it was awesome.
They have right now, they have I think a 2000 Sauvoir, like a Vin Jaune Moscato, and a 1995,
and they're great, huh?
They're not what people, you know, they're very kind of mind-bending,
yeah.
Kind of, I don't know what the fuck I'm tasting was, but that's not a bad thing either.
True. Okay, sorry, I interrupted.
So with Italy, Alessandro Berra, kind of cornered Joe, my dad, and Kevin McKenna, who's been an equal partner in the company for now 20 years, and is very important, and it's important just to mention him, and said, you need to work with my wines. And they said, who are you? What are you talking about? And, you know, it's Moscato, really? But this was at the Dive Bouteille, which is a big fair for natural wines. 2000 was in the earlier stages of it. And she was really good friends with Terry Pousla of Clos du Tubeuf and Pierre Breton. And she basically said, come taste at my table. So they did. And they said, okay, you know, thanks for having us taste. We'll think about it. Kevin is half Italian, fluent in Italian, lived in Rome for a while, and was for 2 years, I believe, and was a huge impetus in this. My mother and father, particularly my dad, were really against it. They said, you know, at this point, the company was 12 years old. They'd found their niche with Loire and Beaujolais and the Mâconnais, and It meant learning everything from scratch, because remember, they didn't know anything about wine. They're not wine people. And, you know, Italy, there's just so many grapes, so many things to remember, all these new, you know, a language they didn't know. So they were freaking out. No, I don't. We don't want to do it. You know, this is crazy. We already have so much on our plate. But I think Kevin really saw, and, you know, is very fortunate in a way, Kevin really saw this opportunity, because the natural wine movement in Italy was about, you know, 10 to 15 years back from France. And, you know, no one really, I mean, still to this day, no one specializes in Italian natural wines. There's smaller companies now that have started, Critical Mass, Scuola di Vino, that have started mm-hmm. in the last few years. But, you know, in the early 2000s up until even 3 years ago, I mean, So Kevin came back to Alessandra and said, can you please, we're not going to work with you without coming to visit. We can't justify coming to visit just to visit you. So can you please find five or so like-minded producers that you think fit in our book and fit in our categories, and that would work. So... Sorry, I have to blow my nose.
That's okay. I appreciate you. I know you've been under the weather.
Yeah. Just one moment.
And yeah, I'm a big Rachel Maddow fan. And so she has also been under the weather. And I was very happy that she is back on air last night. And so I don't know if you and her have been hanging out.
There's no correlation there.
Okay.
So and then from that five, there was Cascina degli Ulivi in Gavi. There was Cascina Tavin, who's in Monferrato, who makes Barberas and Ruque and Grignolinos, crazy indigenous Piemontese grapes. There was Angelino Malle from La Biancara, who's mm-hmm. an iconic producer in the Veneto, one of the pioneers of really biodynamics and sulfur-free winemaking in Italy, as is, of course, Cascina degli Ulivi. Someone else, I think,
yeah,
maybe not. That's already so. But anyway,
that was the.
They tasted the group. All of those producers came and met,
and there was like five. Like every one of the producers, like wow, this, like these are all great. And
yeah, and then it was like, okay, well, this gives us a foundation to start.
Mm-hmm.
And from that foundation, they started from there. And you know, and then there was just amazing discoveries, like discovering Ariano Chipinti when she was 25 or something. And, you know, she just made her first vintage. Mm-hmm. And we started with her first vintage, you know. So in a way, you know, there was all the trial and error of France for 12 years. I was able to kind of, there was a more honed in, better vision on how to find producers with Italy, which I think is why the Italian book is so dynamic and interesting. Also, so Italy is dynamic and interesting, and there's some really cool stuff. And if anything, you know, I've heard people tell us that they think that, if anything, the craziest, most edgy, cutting-edge stuff we're working with at this point is from Italy. And in a lot of cases, I tend to agree. I mean, you know, and this is all the... checks all the hipster natural wine boxes, you know.
But also delicious.
Yeah,
I mean, these wines are incredible. And it's been cool to see some producers like Elisabetta Foridori, who's kind of evolved as they've been influenced by other producers and learned from other producers as well. One of the things I think about at your tastings, and I know that you guys do, you kind of bring producers together to different cities, is that they must learn so much from each other, from having an importer who really works with all like-minded producers, right? Because in some books you can find some like really, you know, industrially made wines and some really like great natural wines and some things that are like in the middle or transitioning or something. But you guys have like a lot of like-minded producers who are working with different soils. So there must be so much information exchange between them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've heard Kevin say that the thing he's the most proud of with this company is the cross-pollination of mm-hmm. everybody, of other people from totally different regions with different solutions, different ideas, just talking and figuring things out together, learning from each other. And also becoming friends. I really don't know. And, you know, you could, if I'm wrong here, you know, someone correct me, but I've never seen such a group of people under one umbrella who have become so unified and like-minded from co-interacting in wine. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's completely obvious that the influence is felt from one to the other. I mean, for the, you know, in 2010, Elisabetta Fordori traveled the Beaujolais with my parents because she wanted to make Teraldego lighter. So she was hoping to learn about making semi-carbonic Teraldego, and then she tried and it was terrible and undrinkable. So that's what led her to go to the amphoras, mm-hmm. you know, and then now the amphora thing, which of course has caught on in a lot of places for reasons other than Elisabetta. But, you know, now Silvio, her boyfriend at Monte Segundo, who makes wine in Tuscany, makes an amphora Sangiovese that's delicious.
Delicious.
And Eric Texier has those same amphoras from that Spanish producer and makes half of his old vine Roussan in amphora and the half of it in barrel and blends them. I think there's just what's nice about these people is that they're always thinking. There's no absolutes in the vines, in the wines. It's always just about searching to make the best wines possible. And often that means lighter, fresher, more complex in their minds. And it's been, yeah, it's totally fascinating to see that cross-pollination of people working together. It's also inspiring for us, too.
Yeah, I can imagine. And last I saw you, we were at a tasting and you were really passionate about the wines of Roussillon. And I really didn't know a ton about these wines and you were like totally schooling me and everyone else there. I could tell you felt like really strongly that people should be drinking these wines, the good ones, obviously. And they weren't really like getting their due. Is there another place in the wine world that you feel strongly about? And have you, since we last spoke about Roussillon, have you started to see them around a little bit more too?
You know, it's, no, not really. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's. I think the Roussillon is still the biggest fight to have. It's like mm-hmm. it still has this reputation, like the Beaujolais had 20, 30 years ago, like Muscadet had 20, 30 years ago, of bulk, you know, inexpensive industrial wine. And there are, you know, there's some importers like Kemi Riviere, I think, is the best example, who's really honed in on just making her book about the Roussillon, which is great. And, you know, when that's all you have to sell, that's, you know, you're going to sell it. So that's, you know, I think that's a good step forward. But that region is just, you know, kind of, there's just kind of this thing where people really have a false impression about it that bothers me.
Is that the Languedoc's fault? That there's so many like mass-produced wines?
Well, lumping them together is totally absurd. Mm-hmm. They're completely different places. The Languedoc and the Roussillon are completely different. The Roussillon is much more influenced by the Basque country and Basque culture. And the Languedoc and also has more schist, gneiss, and, you know, those types of soils. Granite soils, while the Roussillon, while the Languedoc is much more influenced by Provence, much more French in style, and is more clay and limestone. So it makes no sense. And they have complete, like, the Roussillon has, I think, 100 times less rain than the Languedoc. Languedoc's a much higher yielding region. So lumping them together is totally absurd.
Doesn't make any sense.
Okay. And it's lazy and yeah. So I think that's still, I mean, at least in France, that's to talk about. I think the biggest place I would say that I think, and we're the biggest, you know, we're fighting very hard through who we represent right now, is Emilia-Romagna.
Yes.
Emilia-Romagna to me is, I mean, saying it's the Beaujolais or the Loire of Italy is a stretch, but mm-hmm. I feel that way when I'm there because there is this joie de vivre. There's this effort to make kind of very affordable, quaffable, enjoyable wines that are about just eating and having a good time. And they make all these, you know, like, the, you know, they're essentially pet nats. They all make pet nats that are awesome, mm-hmm. but they're tannic. They have, you know, like skin contact. And there's all these weird indigenous grapes like the Loire. And the wines are awesome. The wines are super easy to drink unless, you know, you want to make, you know, there's of course more structured examples. And the food there is amazing. The vibe there is amazing. And the, you know, people, at least in America, but I think, in, you know, people like, you know, the, like that frontier of just like all the different types of sparklings, the Rosatos, especially the reds. Sparkling reds is, I think, the final frontier for the American drinker. Although some of our gassier producers are halfway there. But that's a region that, you know, we...
I share your enthusiasm, yeah. And I just got back. I was there for like 8 days with my girlfriend, and you guys have some of the most interesting producers. We have Orsi, who I love, and I said had lunch with him, and he's just such a cool guy. He's doing really special things. I have Tedeschi, Camillo Donati, my favorite Lambrusco, Luciano Saietti. Mm-hmm. Am I missing
some? Yeah, Vittorio Graziano, who's like basically... You know, that's the real unicorn wine that we work with. I mean, that shit, like, we're his importer, and we've been his importer for 4 years, and this is, we're getting a third shipment just that arrived.
Jesus.
He's impossible to get a hold of, and those wines are incredible. Anyone who knows those calls him the master, el maestro of Lambrusco.
Wow. Those, okay, I've got to check that out.
Cadenocci, La Stopa, of course.
La Stopa, who we visited. Do you work with Croce? Do you know those wines?
Yes, I do know the Croce wines.
You don't work with Croce?
We do not work with Croce.
Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Yes. but I like the wines a lot.
I do too.
And
I like them, and they're in Emilia-Romagna, so I assume that you worked with them.
Well, you know. So
that's big. That's going big on a region that's really not known for their wines.
Exactly. And it's, you know, and there's a lot of them are like, they're Lambruscos, but they don't say Lambrusco on it. So that's another whole kind of people. It doesn't say Lambrusco, or, you know, and that whole region, I just think is totally misunderstood and maligned. And the terroirs are amazing. It's that's my Roussillon of Italy.
I love it, and I wouldn't have put it together, but it makes total sense. And the thing also I love about it is that those wines are delicious. They have a lot of personality, but all inexpensive, like all just total relative bargains. Like, you can have such a wine with such personality and so drinkable, and you're not spending a ton of money.
And that goes back to, you know, that same ethos of the Loire and Beaujolais, where it's just, you know, I mean, those are wines that are very modestly priced for the quality.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I
love it.
We're doubling down on Emilia Romagna. So that's,
it's brilliant. Yeah. And I think those wines, they need to go. I mean, all these great wines, you're talking about food, but the food's so rich there and so delicious. And those wines are just like all begging. They're like perfect, perfect food wines to me.
Yeah, but those are also, they're very versatile. You could eat anything with those.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're okay. You know, effervescent and like, you know, skin contact, white effervescent. I mean, that's the most versatile wine I can think of. And they're all low in alcohol too. They're all super low ABV.
I love that.
You know, for Italy, which is great.
Yeah, and you can drink a lot. You're not getting a headache. You're not getting a hangover. Drink a little bit of water. You'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get a better idea of this at the start of the show. I'm sorry I'm leaving it to probably what's might be our last question. But can you give us an idea as to what your life's like? What, like, I feel like I picture you traveling and spending a ton of time with growers and producers all the time. You're in a lot of these, you know, making these videos that are awesome and super informative. How much time do you have to spend traveling? How much time do you spend here? What is it like to be Jules Dresner when it comes to work, at least?
Yeah. Okay. otherwise we're going to need a lot more than 10 minutes, but, for work, I mean, I'm based in New York City. I live in Brooklyn, and I, you know, we go to Europe. I go to Europe 4 times a year. There's 2 trips to Italy, 2 trips to France. Those tend to be about 2 weeks. Some we bring customers, some we don't. Then there's a larger extended period in France in the summer where we cover more ground. There's a lot of travel, a little bit of downtime, but mostly visiting producers. I'm here, you know, it's the people have this idea that being a wine importer is this glamorous life of travel and eating and drinking, and it's certainly a part of it, but most of my days involve staring at a computer screen, hearing people complain about the warehouse misdelivering something, figuring out how to get containers together to consolidate pallets. It's a lot, you know, it's a lot of it's just staring at a computer screen, getting logistics done.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
There's some glamour stuff.
If you're asking the work part of it, you know, I mean, and then of course, you know, I write the website, which is very time consuming. When there's actual content to write, but
and tons that, of great content,
and
there.
And the content just comes from the trips. The trips are, you know,
I like that the content is. It seems like it is, and it is firsthand, first source content. It's not flowery. This is what someone said when I was, this is exactly what we experienced.
Yeah. Well, there's some editing, but it's fairly stream of conscious and kind of just kind of giving, kind of a raw overview of what happened during that visit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. I mean, I have a social life, as my grandma always asked me, how's your social life? You know, that's work. I mean, you know, we're a tiny company in the end, I think people don't.
I wanted to ask you because I was looking through all the producers and it's like, oh my God, that is one just great producer after a great producer. And if you go through and look at the 120 producers or so right now on the website, it's like, I'm sure that's not the right number. But
123. And growing. There's more.
It's like, how are there so many fantastic producers in one portfolio? It makes you think that it's a bigger company than you think it is, but is it would you characterize yourself as a larger company?
No, I think our reputation is much larger than the size of our company. Although, I mean, we sell a good amount of wine, you know, to be fair, but we are seven people who do everything. We have an office manager, Sheila. We've got my mom, Kevin, my mom, Denise, Kevin, myself at the office. So there's four people in the office on a daily basis. We have a national sales manager, Josefa, who lives in Chicago, mm-hmm. who's based in Chicago. And then we have two salespeople who do the direct book, which we won't have time to touch on, but that's more smaller quality esoteric stuff that we distribute within New York City.
Right.
So that's everybody.
That's everybody.
And, you know, we kind of, you know, we do everything, basically. And it's part of the success is keeping it, you know, we work in a very particular way that's not exactly intuitive to the average business, I would say. But it works for us. And, the scale of what we're doing has gotten much larger, but the scale of from the inside remains quite small and intimate. And
it's great.
Yeah.
All right. That's been Jules Dresner of Louis Dresner Selections. You can very easily figure out what is a Louis Dresner Selection wine by just looking at the back of the bottle. And if it says the company's name on the label, you know it's going to be delicious. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Joe.
Here. I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank David Tadashore, who just put this whole show together and is the man. Some help was provided by Haley Crane, who's an intern here at Heritage for another month or so. She's been awesome. And the executive director of Heritage. Thank you, Katie. You're the best. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.